Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Yes, it is. Kia ora, MOTAT, and kia ora, Marcus. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, thanks. How are you?
I'm great. And there's some very, very interesting stories here today. In particular, this first one about a man who can read letters but not numbers. And I think really people need to go along and find the story because it is quite a visual thing to be able to see his interpretation of the number 8. He kind of, in attempting to draw it, draws this abstract orange kind of monster-looking thing.
That's so, right, yeah.
But this is a man who used to be able to read numbers. So what changed?
Yeah, so this guy was an engineering geologist who was in his late 60s around about 2010 when he began to get some pretty severe headaches. Amnesia, some tremors, and he started having difficulty walking. Doctors couldn't really determine a cause. They suspected a stroke, but then they discovered he had a disease called cortical basal syndrome, which is something that kills off brain cells. And it seemed like it killed off some brain cells that were important for recognizing numbers. Because this guy, he can read words and letters just fine. He was obviously a very numerate, in a sort of a numerate sort of career, but he cannot read numbers anymore. He cannot recognize numbers. He just cannot see them.
So what does that tell us about what is the difference between a number and a letter and where they might be stored in the brain?
So it indicates that letters and numbers are treated differently in the brain. He could still do mental arithmetic. He could still think about numbers, but looking at them, he actually felt almost a revulsion feeling when he saw images of numbers. So there's a video of him with a foam number 8. He was holding it, and he could turn it. He could twist it. If he turned it around, it looks like a mask. He says. But then he put it upright and he had to hand it over because he just couldn't handle it anymore. But he can still do mental arithmetic and other mathematical operations. Some digits were more scrambled than others. So the digits 2 and 9 were scrambled, but 0 and 1 looked normal. And this could be because they resemble letters. But because also they have more deep associations in the brain between absence and presence. You know, the brain understands something that isn't there, so that's a 0, or unity, which is 1. So in the end, he had to come up with an entirely new digit system for himself, and even had his computer rigged to present the new numerals that he created. This is more interesting because tests revealed that the deficit is not a visual malfunction. He's not just not seeing the numbers. He could see the 8, but only in a horizontal orientation. He couldn't see it in the vertical orientation. It depends on his interpretation of the numbers. So as soon as his unconscious brain registered a number, then his conscious brain went haywire.
Right, and they also talk about the difference between cognition and consciousness in the article a bit too.
Yeah, so it lends support to the idea that the brain has a sort of a specialized module in there for processing numbers. And his ability to recognize and manipulate new figures in that he sort of created his own indicates that he still has all his higher level math abilities there. But importantly, this really could shed light on how conscious awareness arises, yeah? So in another test, the scientists who were testing him showed him pictures of letters and numbers with tiny drawings of faces embedded inside them. Yeah, and so when viewing the letters, he saw the letters, but he also saw the faces that were sort of embedded in the drawings of the letters. And he was connected up to an EEG machine and recording his brain waves, and a brain wave that was particularly associated with seeing faces fired. Yeah. When he was looking at the numbers, he didn't see anything. He didn't see the numbers and he didn't see the faces as well. But the EEG, the brain wave, still showed that his unconscious brain recognized the faces. That same sort of brain wave fired and spiked. But something between that unconscious facial recognition and the conscious understanding that he'd recognized a face was broken. So if it was associated with this number, he couldn't see a thing in his conscious mind. And this is a particular case, and there are it's really interesting to me in this sort of field of research that much of our understanding of how the brain works comes via people who have some sort of fault or some sort of problem in their brain. So this guy had a very specific disease. Other people have parts of their brain missing or have some other brain damage, and it triggers. It helps us to understand, well, how exactly is the brain sort of all wired together? Unfortunately, this is just one guy, and he can't really be studied much further because his health has deteriorated a lot with this illness. And it is just one guy, so it's, how much weight we can put on these findings is questionable. But it represents an interesting sort of link between, the unconscious recognition of something and our conscious sort of understanding of what it is.
Mm. Definitely. And so to move on to the second topic here, we've got about evidence about what vitamin D and whether you have a deficiency in that can mean for your chances of mortality from COVID-19. Now, how did they work this one out?
Okay, so this, first of all, I want to say that we shouldn't all go to the chemist and buy vitamin D supplements and start gulping them down, because the evidence for vitamin D helping when you have COVID or helping to protect you from COVID is very weak at present. But some of this understanding came from a story in the States where in, I guess, March, maybe early April, New York was bracing for COVID. They could see it moving across the country, and people who were charged with looking after a lot of the homeless people in New York, because there is thousands and thousands of homeless people, were petrified because they thought, oh, this community is going to get decimated by this illness. And so the disease got to New York, and cases, as you may remember, New York was hit particularly badly. And but weirdly, they didn't start seeing lots of homeless people getting sick with COVID. And weeks went by and weeks went by, and the general population, the COVID was going crazy. But in the homeless community, there was nowhere near the proportional sort of uptake of the disease. And finally, weeks in, once they got testing, because they were very slow in getting testing arranged, they tested a large number of homeless people. And they found that 40% of them were testing positive for COVID, but very, very few of them actually had any symptoms for the disease. Mm. And one of the hypotheses was that, well, these guys spend a lot of the time outside. And because they're outside, they see some sunshine. And as soon as your body sees sunshine, it starts producing vitamin D. And it turns out that in when you look more widely, one of the very few things that correlates with the rate of COVID death, COVID-related deaths, is the proportion of people with vitamin D deficiency in the population. So the UK, in Europe, the UK and Belgium, I think, are leading Europe in terms of deaths per million population, and they're also leading Europe in terms of the number of vitamin D deficient people.
And it also, in the article, they raise that it gives rise to quite an interesting and quite a serious inequality issue based on skin color, especially for people who may have darker skin living in places like the UK.
Right, exactly. So people with darker skin have higher melanin level, and that produces less vitamin D from the sun. So if people with darker skin live in countries with low rates of sunshine, such as the UK, the vitamin D deficiency, it is weighted towards those populations.
Yeah, and they noted too that 94% of the healthcare workers who died from COVID-19, and I think this is in the UK once again, were from a Black, Asian, or minority ethnic backgrounds.
Yes, that's right. And if you look in New Zealand, according to the Ministry of Health, around 5% of Kiwis are deficient in vitamin D.
Mm. Interestingly, they also raise, I think, in the Scandinavian countries, although maybe not as much sunlight, but apparently they get their vitamin D from fish too.
So that's right, might, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But I liked your warning at the beginning that, yeah, we shouldn't all go out and start munching down vitamin D, but supposing that maybe Donald Trump does suggest this as his new proposed miracle cure, are there any negative side effects to having too much vitamin D?
Yes, you can have too much vitamin. You can overdose. It is possible to take too much. So as with any supplement or medication, you know, proceed with caution. But there is, again, the evidence that this protects you from COVID is not all there yet. Papers are in pre-publication phases, and there isn't sort of a general requirement to go off and eat lots of vitamin D. And in fact, just going outside and having some sunshine is probably good enough anyway.
And a good thing to do anyway, yeah,
yes.
On a beautiful sunny day like today.
That's right.
Now, as we move to our third topic, NASA has launched their most ambitious Mars rover yet. Now, something I didn't realize is that this is actually the third of three rovers that have been launched in the past 10 days, because I understand the United Arab Emirates and China have both also taken advantage of the particular positionings.
Yes, that's right. So this is Mars rover or Mars mission season, I guess.
Mm.
So it just so happens that Earth and Mars are in a particular relative position that makes a journey to Mars less expensive and less time consuming. And so everyone's trying to launch around about now. So you may have seen a few days ago a rocket blasted up, an Atlas V rocket launched what's the biggest, most ambitious Mars rover that's ever been constructed. And I think, and I was thinking back, and I didn't look this up, but I think this is the fifth rover that the US have launched. And each have been sort of progressively bigger, versions of the previous.
Yeah, what are some of those? Because it's got some pretty cool specs on it. What are some of those technologies it's got?
It's going to do a lot. So it's a beefed up version of the previous rover, which was the Curiosity rover, which was launched about 8 years ago, and it's gonna land in about 6 months from now. It costs an awful lot of money, about $2.7 billion. It's plutonium powered, so we're slowly irradiating Mars. Maybe, and it weighs a ton. So this thing is not small. This is like a small car type size rover. But yeah, so it can do a lot. And just a sort of some highlights. It has a couple of zoomable cameras that are high enough resolution that can spot a fly from the other side of a sports field. It's got, and this is an international mission. There are lots of international instruments on the rover. So there's a Spanish-built weather station. There is a Norwegian-built radar to scan layers of the soil and the rock between the planets beneath the planet's surface. There is an advanced version of a laser instrument that Curiosity carried, and that's going to probe rocks to study their chemical makeup. There's going to be two microphones, so for the first time we're actually going to be able to hear Mars. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be recording the sounds of the wind, and it's also going to listen out for any engineering problems on the rover. So if one of the wheels starts squeaking, they'll be able to hear that. And oh, by the way, there's also about 2 kilogram helicopter, which is, I think it's just so cool, called Ingenuity. And that's going to be deployed, and that's going to scout ahead to see where the rover could go. So it's like a little drone that'll scoot around. And if that is successful, this will be the first craft to make a controlled flight on another planet.
Cool.
Yeah. and so also the rover will use an instrument to try and produce oxygen from Mars's carbon dioxide atmosphere, which is something that if we ever go to Mars, is something that we might want to do. So that's going to figure out how to do that.
And that's also in the hope that because this is hoping that it will come back after this mission, right? I think after a year or two.
Right. So not the whole thing, but part of the rover will come back to Earth, and it's going to collect a bunch of samples, store them in tubes inside the rover, and that's going to be retrieved by a future spacecraft. So nothing's going to sort of launch out of the rover, but a future spacecraft is going to go land nearby and retrieve those samples and bring them back. And so it'll be the first sample return mission from
Very
Mars.
Very cool. Yeah. And so we'll look forward to that when it does happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And hopefully it'll find life and little Martians running around.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Oh, well, thank you, Marcus. That's all for today. And I will head us out with an outro.
Mind blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.